We'd like to thank our sponsor, Purina Pro Plan, fuel for life. More sporting dog champions feed Pro Plan than any other brand of dog food.
Are you a football guy?
I am. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I watched the game.
College or NFL? Anyway.
What's that?
College or NFL?
Both. Both. Yeah. I went to the University of Georgia for a couple of years, and that was back when like Herschel Walker and all were there. So it was a good football time. And so I like college. But I also watch NFL too. So
yeah. Did you watch that game last night?
I did.
It was actually
a good game. I won 20 bucks off my buddy. He gave me 6 points. So I had to explain to my wife how I won the bet and the Cowboys lost the game. So she doesn't get it, but
Jeff, did you watch that game last night?
No, we had practice and homework. I looked at my app and there was a delay.
Yeah, there's like an hour rain delay.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And then they came back and nobody scored after that.
All I saw was delay and ejection for spitting. That's it. And that was a
whole thing. It was crazy.
That was after the first series?
The spitting happened before the game even started.
Oh, yeah. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, after the kickoff before the first snap.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, it was wild. But yeah, college football last weekend. Jeff's a Oklahoma fan. I haven't even talked to you about Texas losing.
Oh man, it was a good day.
You lost it.
And Bama lost. It was like,
yeah. I'm a closet Longhorn fan, so.
Oh really?
We don't have to talk about that, but.
Yeah, that's a rough day for you then.
Yeah, and I like Texas and anybody that's playing against Ohio State. So I like lost twice, you know. Yeah, those are my two favorite teams.
Yeah. Are you a Broncos fan or a Cowboys fan? I know you said you bet on the Cowboys.
So I lived in Texas for quite a while. So I kind of became a Cowboys and Longhorns fan. And most of my friends hate me for that. But
yeah, rough fan base to come from.
But now it's easy to start to like the Broncos. So I'm kind of rooting for the Broncos now.
They've got a good team going.
I was never
a big
Sean Payton fan, but I like Bo Nix.
Yeah, they've got potential.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cool. Well, I'd like to jump back into our normal Save for the Blind podcast. This is Carson Odegaard with my normal co-host, Jeff Smith. And today's guest is Carl Gunzer, who is the director of Sporting Dog Group at Nestle Purina Pet Care. So, Carl, welcome to the podcast. We're going to talk all things dogs as well as dog food and a little bit of everything in between. So, again, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, Carl, kind of want to dive in on your background and your personal story. So kind of share with us your background a little bit in the retriever space, and then we'll talk about how you ended up in the role you're in today.
Yeah, sure. So probably the most important thing was, you know, I started off as a duck hunter and then kind of got infatuated with dogs. And, you know, I was competing as an amateur and training, and eventually got offered a job working for a pro actually out in California. So, I moved to California, you know, trained retrievers out there for a few years, and then kind of just started my own business in Texas, moved to Montana and kind of bounced around a little bit. But eventually, I spent 20 some years as a field trial professional, field trialing retrievers, based out of Montana. And I'd go to Texas or Southern California in the winter and, you know, did field trials for like 20 some years, and then got offered a job with Purina. So I've been here now, I guess about 13 years in this role with Purina.
Carl, was that a dream of yours to be a professional trainer, or is that something you just kind of walked into as a hobby?
You know, it's funny. Like, yeah, that's a great question. And I think probably most pros like never knew they wanted to be that, you know, like I was living in Montana. I worked for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and, I was competing as an amateur, you know, with dogs, and I really loved it. Like, that was my kind of hobby, passion, kind of like hunting is now. You know, it's like, what do you want to do when you're not working? And whenever I was not working, I was dog training. And I flew out to California for a week to go train with a guy in Marysville, Jim Dobbs. He ran the Tritronics Training Center at that time. And I took a week's vacation, went out there, trained with him. And at the end of that week, he offered me a job to come back and work for him. So like went back to Montana and quit my job and packed everything in the back of a pickup truck and moved to Sacramento Valley and moved to California. So, kind of a, like an odd, I don't know, you know, that's sort of life, right? Like you'd never know what's going to happen next, but that was really what started. And it was just the passion for dogs and dog training and hunting that sort of took me there.
And what did that job entail? Were you mentioned something about, you know, doing studies or something like that.
Yeah. We were working for, I was hired by Tritronix actually. So Jim worked for Tritronix and that was the electronic collar manufacturer. And they had this research and training center where we would sort of test everything. Like we would train dogs, but we would also like utilize all the equipment in real world times. Like in the mornings, you know, before you'd go training, you'd take like battery readings and all that stuff and then go train all day. And at the end of the day, you know, take battery readings and then charge them overnight. And it was kind of like, just really doing research on electronic collars to help develop, you know, better, you know, like if you remember the old collars would have, they were real big and they'd have a big antenna that you'd pull up and, you know, the transmitters kept getting shorter antennas and the receivers kept getting smaller until like what we have today, which is, you know, all the, you know, a fraction of the size and twice the range and all that. But it was kind of fun to kind of play with electronics and train dogs all day is what we did. We didn't, at that time, we didn't train for the public. We wrote some books and manuals and we did demos kind of across the country. So we'd fly to, you know, different states and just do dog training demos, try to teach people how to use the collar. But then I competed with dogs out there as well. So it was kind of a fun experience till, Tritronix decided they didn't need the research and training center anymore. And then, then we were unemployed, but, no, it was a lot of fun.
How long were you doing that out here?
I think that was about 3 years. Oddly, like I was hired by Tritronix and within 6 months of moving there, they decided to close the training center. So literally I moved to California and 6 months later didn't have a job. But thankfully, Jim Dobbs, who had hired me and, all that kept me on and we started what was then called Dobbs Training Center. And we started selling electronic equipment and then, you know, doing books and seminars and manuals and training dogs for people. So we kind of like sort of got kicked into the real world instead of working for Tritronix. We started, you know, just our own training business.
And as a duck hunter, were you excited to come to California or is it kind of an unknown of what the waterfowl hunting
is? It was a huge unknown, Jeff. It was like, it was really crazy because I left Montana and we had really good duck hunting in Montana.
Where in Montana?
So I lived near Missoula and Stevensville. But we would mostly duck hunt like east of the mountains. And so kind of go over to Shoto and near Great Falls and that area. And I don't know if it's the same. I mean, this has been 30 years ago, but at that time you could basically drive around, find where birds are feeding, go knock on a door and almost always get permission. Like it was truly, not that hard. Now it was hard to get permission to hunt pheasants for whatever reason. Like, you know, they'd be like, yeah, you can go shoot those. I don't know why you'd want to shoot those ducks or geese, but don't shoot my pheasants, you know? So we would, we'd kind of just buzz around. But, so I kind of was worried going to California that the duck hunting wouldn't be good. I actually found out it's really good. Although a lot of it was private, as you guys know. So, but as you know, there was great public hunting opportunities out there, as I'm sure all your listeners know from Gray Lodge and other areas around there, around the Sutter Buttes. There were lots of places that you could actually hunt. And I was fortunate to end up with a few clients that had duck clubs and got invited on a few of the duck clubs. But, I don't think a lot of the world knows the quality or the duck history of California. Like I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay and then hunted, you know, kind of like field ducks and different things. But I was really shocked about what a great waterfowl culture that California actually has.
Yeah. We were talking to, Terry Denman from Mojo the other week, and he kind of said the same thing. Like, he's been out here a lot, and he came out here early on, and you know, a lot of California hunters were trying new things that nobody's ever seen before, and the amount of ducks they could put the items in front of, like, nobody really knew until they came out here, and it's like, oh, we got like a whole culture of hunters out that really nobody knows about.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And even though, so I knew that there was the, you know, I'd hunted rice fields in Texas and all that, but I didn't realize, you know, before I moved there, I didn't realize how much rice California produced, of course. And, you know, you always think of Arkansas, and I think of, you know, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas as, you know, the rice areas, but heck, I'm sure California probably produces as much rice or more than those areas. I don't know that, but, yeah. I'm just guessing, but there's a pile of rice in California.
So you went from basically Tritronix to then working for Dobbs directly. And then did you eventually split off and create your own training company?
Yep, exactly. Yep. That's what I moved to Texas and started my own business, kind of doing young dogs and training like derby and qualifying and like hunt test level dogs, and then moved back to Montana, kind of where I had left when I moved to California, and I started, training there, like open all age field trial dogs, running nationals at a higher level. And then was there for, I guess, probably 15 years. I would be in Montana like half the year. So probably, you know, April till October, November, and then we'd go south depending. Sometimes I'd go to, you know, Florida for a couple months if I had a place to train there, or to Texas, or, you know, we'd gone to Southern California for a while, down around Brawley, Calipatria area near the Salton Sea, which is another, you know, we'd see people down there duck hunting around the Salton Sea too. So it was kind of cool. That's a different environment to duck hunt altogether. Yeah, again,
it's just a different environment, period. Down there. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So how does somebody who's been, you know, training dogs all of a sudden, you know, I guess Purina dog food, but how do you make that connection, and then how did it fold into a job?
Yeah, right. Well, I fed a lot of Proplan, right? So I was feeding Purina, and I had tried a few different, you know, foods throughout the time, and really nothing compared in my mind to Proplan. So that's what I kept feeding. And, I got to know, so Purina, and that's sort of how I ended up in the role I'm in. Purina sponsors, you know, thousands of sporting dog events a year, you know, probably, you know, like the National Retriever Championship, National Bird Dog Championship, all those events. And so Purina sends somebody to those events and kind of to be a representative of the company. And so I got to know those people at the events, and, started doing some work sort of I guess this was before there was really the influencers were even a thing, but I started, you know, kind of representing Purina at some events. There wasn't really even social media at that time, but they would basically say, hey, you want to be a sponsored influential and, you know, attend some events for us and promote our brands, and, you know, we'll do this for you. And so I kind of got to know, the team at Purina, and really they were just great people. And so I had been working for them for a few years, kind of like a part-time, we called it a consultant deal. So I would, you know, represent them at events. And basically my business got so busy that, I really didn't have time to do events for Purina anymore. So I told Bob West, who was, you know, in my position at that time, I told Bob, I was like, you know, I'm sorry, but my dog training business is too important for me to start, you know, have a little side gig. I'm just too busy. I said, I love the company. I love you guys, but you know, I can't really do anything part-time. I said, if you ever have a full-time job again someday, you know, reach out to me, but I can't do it part-time. And literally like 10 years later, like Bob calls and he's like, hey, we got a full-time job now. Are you interested? I'm like, well, I don't know. I guess. So, I wasn't looking for a job training dogs with Jim Dobbs. I wasn't really looking to quit dog training either, but, Bob just kind of talked me into it. You know, it was a chance to, in some ways, give back to the sport I love. Like I knew, you know, how much Purina did for dog sports. I knew that after, you know, 20 years of self-employment, it would be really cool to have things like health insurance and maybe retirement and that kind of stuff. So that was a attractive. So I don't know. There are a lot of things that just led to a shift and a new decision. But again, it was just like kind of an unexpected thing that now, you know, 13 or 14 years later, here I am doing this job. So,
and why do, you know, more sporting dogs champions feed ProPlan than any other brand? And can you speak to the effect of, like, you know, what's in the actual dog food and what makes your brand much better than others or competitors?
Yeah. Well, and I, it'd probably be a little unfair to say like a blanket statement that it is better than others, but I know what we do and I don't know what everyone else does, but I know, so, you know, Purina has been around. First off, like the company's been around since, I think, like, I don't know, 1894. So it's like, you know, the company has been in the livestock or feed business for 100 and some years. Basically, Purina made the first, pet foods with dog chow, like in, a dog chow started in like 1926. So like we're like next year will be 100 years of that brand. And you try and think of how many brands have been around for 100 years. I mean, it's literally like the oldest dog food brand, but Purina is always like, there's 500 researchers and scientists that work at Purina that are constantly trying to develop, you know, new, better pet foods. And I think, you know, they discovered, Purina is the first company to use real meat as a first ingredient. So like ProPlan uses real meat as a first ingredient. It's higher in protein and fat. So it's really effective for sporting dogs for energy. So dogs, you know, the higher fats, you know, dogs use fat as their first, is their best fuel. So, you know, you've got carbs, protein and fat, and dogs utilize fat for energy as sort of their best source of energy. So ProPlan started one of the first higher fat diets. I think, you know, in like 1987, ProPlan started with, you know, a 30% fat, where most, like, I think a dog chow fat is probably like, you know, 15% fat. Like it's much lower. Or excuse me, 20% is 30% protein, 20% fat. And like dog chow would be like 15% fat or 13%. So ProPlan was a higher fat, higher protein. And what was found is that it really helps performance dogs, have more energy, more stamina, higher oxygen metabolism. So like for an athlete, you know, the longer you can run, the higher your oxygen metabolism, the longer you can run, the more energy, the more endurance that you have. And so ProPlan developed these formulas, really with endurance athletes in mind. So, I think at that point you saw all of the people that competed with dogs moving to these higher protein and higher fat diets as, I don't want to say an advantage, but like, you know, all of these dogs are really trained to a high level and they're really, you know, they're great genetics. There's really good training, but you need to have, you know, kind of the third leg of the stool is nutrition. So everyone started moving to really making sure that you're feeding a high quality nutrition, because you start doing these big, you know, field trial tests, or if you're campaigning bird dogs where these dogs are running for miles, you know, having more energy equals a better performance. You know, you don't get winded as fast, you have more endurance. And so there became sort of this big shift towards feeding higher quality foods, where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I think, you know, the joke was people that would feed whatever prevents death, right? Like, you know, as long as your dogs are doing okay, they didn't realize that nutrition was actually something that could impact performance. So I think as ProPlan and Purina were sort of the leaders in this movement, I think is what really helped a lot of people, you know, start utilizing ProPlan, for their competition dogs. And that's really why, you know, we see that more people that are competing are feeding ProPlan than any other brand. And that's not just a marketing deal. I mean, we know that that's true. Like we keep track of all of the national championships, the biggest events, and truly, like if you go to the Retriever National Championship, more than 90% of the starting dogs feed ProPlan. I mean, it's pretty amazing. If you go to the Master National, I mean, it's not going to be quite that high, but it's still going to be 60 to 70% of the dogs competing are eating ProPlan. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So you're talking about, obviously, the dogs that you're around and you're training are higher level athletes, we'll call them, and they're eating the ProPlan. Is ProPlan also okay for average Joe Schmo duck hunter from California, or should they be feeding their dog something else?
Good question. So there are different formulas in the brand. So ProPlan is still going to be like, you know, the highest quality ingredients, the highest quality processing, you know, higher protein and fat. So more of the protein is going to come from animal proteins than, you know, vegetable based proteins. Like people always think that protein, they only think of meat. I mean, there's protein in corn and peas and everything else, but ProPlan is going to have a higher percentage of protein coming from a meat source than, say, a dog chow or something. So, it really is a great formula for all dogs that will benefit from it, but they don't have to eat the 30, 20, you know, higher performance, higher protein and fat. They're fine with, like, we have an adult maintenance. We have different levels of the sport. Like there's a sport 30, 20. There's a sport 26, 16, which is probably about, you know, 15 to 20% fewer calories per serving. So there's a broad variety of formulas. You know, there's growth formulas. So for like a puppy, you want a puppy formula. We've got weight management formulas for dogs that are overweight. And then, you know, of course, the senior dogs, we've got senior formulas for those. So I think that's an important piece of the brand, is there's a wide variety of formulas to fit the unique needs of any dog.
And when people are looking at dog foods, I mean, maybe some people are just more of a price point. They go in and see the cheapest dog food there is, and then the next month they might switch to another brand. Yep. How important is it to keep a dog on, you know, the same thing, you know, month after month after month, or year after year?
You know, it's funny, people often think of their own diets and think, my God, I would not want to eat the same food
no, every thanks. Day
of my life, right? Can you please give me something else? I don't know. Like, I literally fed dogs for like 13 years on like the same formula. And now maybe they can't complain, but they never seemed to complain. You know, they ate it and they look great and did well. So, I don't think variety from a dog's perspective is something that's a real thing. I mean, I think they're happy to eat, and they, you know, I always say about people, you've got some people that eat to live and other people that live to eat, right? Like I'm not a foodie. I don't really like, yeah, of course I like a good meal. Who doesn't? But I mean, that's not something that means anything to me. I eat just so that I can live, so that I can go hunting or horseback riding or dog training or whatever, you know, I want to do. And, I think, you know, there's other people that their meal is like, hey, let's go to, I don't know, Sacramento and have, you know, a fancy dinner at some cool restaurant. Like, I don't believe dogs feel that way. I think they just, you know, eat to live. So I don't think variety really matters. I think, you know, a high quality food with good ingredients, that's manufactured properly. You know, one thing we don't talk a lot about or hear about is all of the micronutrients and ingredients, like, you know, DHA and EPA, which is like fish oils, omega-3s and sixes, which contribute to, you know, healthy skin and coat and, you know, healthy joints and, you know, that kind of stuff, which, you know, the higher quality dog foods are going to have more glucosamine and chondroitin and fish oil and EPA and DHA and all these different ingredients that are helpful for the dog's life. And so, I think there is a value in a higher quality dog food. And then you don't need to supplement. You know, a lot of people like to supplement. And there's good reasons to supplement, you know, older dogs that are getting arthritic, maybe additional, you know, joint cares or things like that, or different skin, you know, depending on the dog, there's certainly a case for some supplements, but really a good, complete and balanced dog food is really the first step in good health.
And I'm seeing, you know, it's been around obviously for a while, but it just seems like there's an uptick in dog food where it's like, you know, salmon or buffalo or name what other kind of like off, you know,
have your meat dog source. Eat what you're eating.
Yeah.
Whole leg.
Kangaroo or whatever. Yeah. Jeff, I think a lot of that's probably marketing. There is a case for some novel proteins for dogs that might have, different allergies, like protein allergies, ingredient allergies, like going to a different protein source can be a thing. But honestly, the number of dogs that have an allergy to, like, you know, chicken or beef or lamb or whatever is way lower than most people think. You know, and likewise with grains. I mean, that's kind of, you hear that as a big deal. Like, is it a grain-free food? The dogs are actually more likely to have an allergy to a protein like chicken than they are to corn or wheat or soy. But a lot of like the human marketing mind of like, hey, I'm gluten free or, you know, low carb, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. That kind of spills over into the dog food marketing and companies use that as product differentiation. So they'll say, hey, you know, like, you know, and, you know, backing up, Purina really believes in the science and Proplan follows the science. And there's no science that shows that grain-free foods are better than foods with grain. In fact, there's recent research and information that actually maybe points to the opposite, that it is good to have some grains, in food. So we don't make Proplan. We don't make a grain-free Proplan. We make some with different ingredients and some have ingredients that others don't have or whatever, but that's really not a basis for our science. We follow science and the science says that grains are good for dogs. And, you know, for the people that say, well, wolves didn't eat, you know, grain. You know, dogs have adapted over thousands of years. And I hate to tell people that, you know, your peek-a-poo or whatever is not a wolf, right? I mean, they're so far from a wolf now that, you know, they're still the same, you know, sort of species maybe, but they're, you know, they have adapted and dogs now are able to digest grains and carbohydrates much better than a wolf. So, there is reasons to have those ingredients. But so, like I said, I think a lot of that, different protein sources is marketing, but there is, you know, there are some cases where there is value in a different protein source.
Like, is there a positive or a negative, you know, from dry food versus wet food?
The biggest, you know, wet foods are more palatable, so they taste better. But they're also like 60% water and they're more expensive and they tend not to be as nutrient dense. So for like a working dog, a hardworking dog, it's hard for a wet food to give them the calories and nutrition that they need. And it's also quite expensive. Mm-hmm. So, I think most working dogs are doing better on like a more nutrient dense kibble. And then if people like, you know, to treat the dog or if the dog is super picky, they can blend in a little bit of wet food. But I think that's better as more of a topper or an additional thing. And one good thing about, the wet food is it does help promote hydration. I mean, I think that's maybe one of the things people need to be cautious with when they're feeding a dry food is make sure that dogs have, you know, plenty of water. We usually recommend in working dogs or sporting dogs is floating the food. So adding some water to the dry kibble when they eat depends a little bit on the dog. Like in some cases it works. In other cases, dogs don't like it or they may gulp differently, but in general, I think it's a good idea to float food, especially in a sporting dog. Like if you're working or traveling, just to add additional hydration. That's one of the nice things about wet food is they're getting, you know, moisture while they're eating with the wet food.
Our next hunt program deadline is September 20th. So this includes all of our opening day waterfowl hunts scattered throughout California. We also have some upcoming events. We have a pocket recruitment on September 10th. We have two events on September 11th, the Black Hawk Banquet and the Marin County Banquet. We also have bingo in Bishop on September 18th. You can find all this information at calwaterfowl.org. Don't forget September 20th, opening day waterfowl hunts, calwaterfowl.org.
That's interesting. I have a black lab and I don't think he would care if his food was dry, wet, on fire, frozen. It doesn't seem to matter. I was just thinking in my head, how often in your training days did you get a lab that was picky enough where you'd have to switch up wet food?
Carson, in a kennel environment, like, I don't want to say never, but I mean, they figured out, and you know, that's one of the things I always try and tell people, like with puppies and all that, is it's really helpful to train your dog to eat. And it sounds weird, like dogs are born wanting to eat. Obviously they are, but they're also, they can be creatures of habit or lazy, and they can get picky. And really, like with puppies and all that, I think one of the great strategies is to put food down, give them 5 minutes. And if they don't eat it in 5 minutes, pick it up. And then, you know, their next feeding, you know, you need to feed the appropriate amounts, but, like I just, in a kennel environment where you've got a bunch of dogs eating and there's so much excitement around mealtime, even a dog that doesn't eat, like you'd put that food down the first day and they might take a couple bites and play around with it and then leave it. I would pick it up. And, you know, after a couple days, they figured out pretty quick, like, hey, you know what? I need to eat dinner here. Otherwise there is no dinner. And so for the like 1 out of 100 labs that came into the kennel, not having an appetite, by the time he left, he figured out the deal. Like, okay, eat when it's presented, you know?
That's so interesting you say that, because like I said, my lab eats food no matter what. My wife's mini golden doodle kind of is on that same mentality, I think, because she grew up with the lab eating. And then both times that we've watched my in-laws' dogs, who are grazers, one's a standard poodle and one's a little cattle dog, and they are kind of same thing, have had their food out forever, graze. Both times they've been here, they've eaten their food like as soon as it comes down. And then we tell my mother-in-law, and she's like, that never happens at our house. And then same thing with my sister. She dropped off her Boston Terrier last week, grazer, dog house, all the food right as it went down. It was like that pack mentality just must be going through them, that, oh, everybody's eating, everybody's excited, I better eat.
Yeah. And if I don't eat, maybe he'll eat mine.
Yeah. It was super interesting.
There's the biggest reason people are like, what's wrong with grazing? And maybe probably nothing. The thing is that, like, if you've got a dog that you feed and it eats its food and all that, if that dog's feeling sick and you put that food down and it doesn't eat, that's like an immediate cue. You're like, oh, how come he's not eating? Like,
yeah, my dog didn't eat, something would be wrong.
Yeah, you're like immediately going, he's sick. Where a grazer, you may not notice that for a couple of days. And then, you know, also, like, if you're going to work a dog, if it's a grazer, like, what if that dog, you know, decides he's going to eat his meal right before you go hunting. And now you got a dog that you take hunting and he's got a full stomach. And now he's got to try and run on a full stomach, which is not good for the dog or, you know, digestion or any of that stuff. He's inevitably going to get diarrhea and start colitis and all those things. So it's like, there's lots of really good reasons as a, you know, either a trainer or a hunter to portion food. And then you can really watch their weight too and control their weight. It's a lot harder if they're a grazer to kind of control their weight, you know.
Yeah. You had mentioned feeding times. What do you recommend for, we'll tag on the hunting side of it, hunters and their hunting dogs?
So I'll start with a theory of the kind of what I was mentioning. You don't want a dog to run with food in their stomach. It, you know, digestion takes blood flow, and that blood flow, if a dog is hunting and running, he needs that blood flow in his muscles and his legs and, you know, his brain and everything else. And if he, it's going to cause diarrhea and stomach issues and colitis if you run a dog with food in the stomach. So based on that, my recommendation is once a day in the evening. So the dog has, you know, basically 12 hours for that food to get out of the stomach, to get fully digested. It can take up to 24 hours for food to get through a dog's system. So it's at least 12, and it depends, you know, some foods digest quicker than others. Depends a little on the dog and how it's fed, but, you know, it's going to take at least a couple hours for food to get out of the stomach. So, I mean, it's going to depend how much, but like a full meal could take a couple hours. So if you feed a dog at, you know, 7 a.m. and then go run it at 8 or 9, it's still going to have food in its stomach. And even what's not in its stomach is already in the small intestine, and that needs blood flow for digestion. So, so my recommendation is once a day in the evening. Now, if a dog either, you know, maybe has hypoglycemia or is a hard keeper where it needs, you know, a greater amount of food to keep weight on, then, you know, you can feed a couple times a day. But the important thing is to give it enough time after that morning meal for that food to be digested at a minimum out of the stomach, you know, hopefully move through digestive tract more. I'd say at least 2 hours, 3 or 4 would be better. But, you know, I just think, you know, if you think about it, you know, people say, well, what's my dog going to like, what's going to keep him going all day if I don't feed him in the morning? Well, what you feed him in the morning is in his stomach. It's in his intestines. That's not metabolized food ready to be fuel. You know, the fuel is already in his muscles and is in, you know, has been absorbed in glycogen and all those things. And that's what's going to be used. So, I mean, if we took a page from like the sled dog guys, they typically would feed, you know, 18 to 24 hours before their first day of racing. So you're not feeding them, you know, 12 hours before they race. You're feeding them 18 to 24 hours before they start running, and you're not feeding them again until after they start running. Now, if it's a multi-day race, obviously you can't wait, you know, that long in between meals. You're going to have to feed them as they get breaks and as they take rests and all that. But really, that food in the digestive system is not energy. It's just packing along extra weight and heat. So,
is there any strategies of like, you know, peak hunting season or peak trial season where you're adjusting food, you know, amounts, or is it basically just keep to the same program every day, same time, same amount?
Yeah, no, for sure. I would say with the field trial dogs that are constantly in training, there's not a lot of change. Like their portion is kind of their portion, and there may be small ups and downs, but if they're always working, you know, they kind of get fit and they have a metabolism that they need. For the one thing is, in cold weather, it takes a lot more calories for dogs to maintain heat, especially if they live outside. Let's say they're a kennel dog and they're outside.
What's considered cold since we're in California?
it's a sliding scale. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. Below 80. No, I'm kidding. Depends. I've been up in Redding and Red Bluff in the wintertime, and it can get dang cold there too.
Oh yeah.
Cold and wet. But, so there's research that shows, and I'm trying to get this right. It's either, I think for every 10 degree drop in temperature, a dog needs 7% more calories for warmth. Now, so if you, you know, likewise, if it's 30 degrees and it gets, you know, 20 degrees warmer, they could need like 14% fewer calories. So let's just think of it as it changes from what's normal. If it's just a, you know, a regular dog, it's burning those calories to stay warm. So, while I can't give an exact like percentage more or what is cold, all I can say is if it was 80 degrees and now it's 40 degrees, your dog probably needs, you know, was it 7 times, you know, like 20, let's say 20% more calories to live in 40 degrees than it does in 80 degrees. So in the wintertime, you're going to be increasing calories, to keep the same weight if your exercise stays the same. And same way, like if, as it moves to summertime, if you don't decrease the amount you're feeding, your dog's going to start putting on weight just because it doesn't need to burn calories to produce heat to stay warm. So I think, you know, for hunting season, definitely, you know, it depends too. Like I always say hunting season, and then I think about like, you know, 20 years ago, I got to go hunting like 3 times a year. Well, I didn't need my dog in peak condition for the three hunts where I maybe shot two ducks, right? Like that, that really wasn't anything different. But, you know, like the bird dog guys, you know, if you are a diehard, you know, upland hunter and, you know, you go, you know, take a 2-week trip to Montana in October, you know, by the end of that 2-week trip, your dog is going to be skinny, you know, even, and one of the problems is as you travel and you're good at new places, you know, that's when dogs do tend to like maybe not eat as good because they're not home or they're in a crate or a truck or, you know, they get stressed because they're running or, you know, just things are different. And then maybe they go off their food a little bit. Next thing you know, they're getting skinny. So, I think, you know, the amounts that are on dog food bags, the recommended feeding analysis, that is a great place to start. But I've seen dogs that need twice or three times a recommended daily feeding, depending on how hard they're working and that dog's metabolism. Likewise, there's dogs that need less, you know, and so, it's sort of a balance. And there is a body condition score chart that you can look at. I think, I don't know, if you go to Purina.com, you can find it there, but you could just Google BCS, body condition score, chart for dogs, and it'll show people like, you know, they really should, you should be able to see a few ribs on a thin skinned dog or on a thick haired dog like your Chesapeake. You should be able to feel a few ribs, you know? So, it's, you know, you want them kind of like, you know, our runners. You don't see any, overweight marathon runners. You know, you really shouldn't see overweight canine athletes either. It's just harder on their bodies, on their joints, on their, you know, muscles, bones, everything. They're more injury prone. So, you know, a lean dog is usually a healthy dog. And if you look at like the real athletes, like the bird dogs and the sled dogs, you know, those dogs, they are ripped and they have no fat on them, you know?
So I want to kind of go back a little bit when we were talking about all the different formulas and plans that Purina comes out with. How does somebody go about choosing the right one for their dog? They're like, oh, my dog is this, but where does it fall into the category? Is there like a survey they can take on the website that'll kind of steer them in the right direction? Or is it just a mix and match game of guessing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I wouldn't even have thought of that, but you mentioned it. And we do have a, I think it's called like My Plan. You can go on to like ProPlan.com and select My Plan and put in information. So what that little computer does is it looks at, you know, the body condition score. Like, is it light? Is your dog heavy or light? It'll look at the breed. It'll look at it activity level. It'll look at life stage. So is it a, you know, how old is the dog? And that changed a little bit for the breed. Like, you know, bigger dogs are growing longer than little dogs. And so it takes all that into account and then sort of spits out a list of potential, you know, good choices for your dog. And then there's lots of different ones that would fit in that category. It's not going to come down and say, oh, you know, you need to feed, you know, ProPlan Complete Essentials salmon, you know, 2.5 cups a day, but it will give you like a list of foods that are, you know, recommended. And then it becomes a little bit of a trial and error. I usually recommend people start with a little smaller bag, like instead of buying a, you know, 50-pound bag of, you know, ProPlan Sport Chicken, you know, buy a 6 or an 18-pound bag and A, make sure the dog likes it, make sure, you know, they do good on it and eat it well. And then you can kind of play around. You know, some formulas have, you know, different textures or shreds in them. Others are just straight kibble. So there's a wide variety. But yeah, that's a great way to do it is just use that little formula finder on My Plan.
We kind of touched it earlier, but could you talk about the difference between, you know, hunt test and field trials? And did you prepare dogs differently from those types of tests?
Yeah, that's a great point. So they're different, but they're the same. I think the biggest thing to explain to people is that a field trial is competitive, one dog against another. So if you have, you know, 80 dogs in a open at the end of 3 days or 2 days, depending how fast it goes, you're going to have one winner and a second place, third place, etc. There's four places. And in order to become a field champion, you have to have a win. Yeah. So you have to have won an all age open and then have so many points, like a, you know, 2 seconds or a second and 2/3 or whatever. Hunt tests are similar, but they're not competitive one dog against another. They're competitive against a standard. And so you might have 80 dogs in a master test and, you know, 20 or let's say 40 of them pass and the other 40 do not pass. And so to get a title in the hunt test, you have to have, you know, so many passes. So like, you know, depending on what level, like you'd have to have 5 master passes to become a master hunter. You know, if they were senior hunter. So there's different, they're different games. The field trial game, because it's competitive one dog against another, it gets more extreme. You know, the tests get longer, tougher, you know, more challenging, and it just gets a lot harder because the judges have to separate those dogs and they have to pick a winner at the end of the event. So, you know, it's not uncommon to see field trial marks that are 300 and 400 yards and blinds that are 300 and 400 yards. You know, you could have a swim with a 20-minute test. It could, you know, have several, you know, 100-yard swims, where the hunt tests, are designed not to be as challenging because it's against the standard. And you don't want the standard to be so hard that, you know, very few dogs pass it. So, they restrict distances and put some limitations. I think, you know, 100 yards is about as long as you typically see a hunt test mark. You know, you'll see some longer, and they have, the rules have changed a few times, and I don't run them anymore. So I'm not hip whether it's, you know, if it can't be more than 150 or 125, but you know, there's a few limitations, and there's actually different formats. So you've got, you know, AKC, HRC, you know, Super Retriever Series. There's different formats. I would say that hunt tests do simulate hunting more than a field trial. In a field trial, you've got a gunner that's in a white coat so that the dogs can see, you know, the gun throw the bird. At a hunt test, all the guns are hidden. They blow duck calls at hunt tests. And, you know, in 20 some years of field trialing, I never saw a duck call blown. Not to say it couldn't happen, but, in hunt tests, oftentimes the handlers, depending on the format, they either have to, you know, hold and fire a gun. You know, it'd be a pop or a blank, but they either have to hold and fire or guns are shot in the field. So, you know, hunt tests are a lot more like hunting than field trials. That said, field trial dogs can make great hunting dogs because, you know, they have a higher capacity for difficulty. You know, they run farther, straighter. They have to be a little, mark a little better to be competitive. So, and, you know, hunt test dogs can be field trial dogs and field trial dogs can be hunt test dogs. It's just like I said, it's a different format. I've known lots of dogs that were successful at both. I would say it's probably easier to train a dog to be a field trial dog and then do hunt tests than it is to take a, you know, a 5-year-old hunt test dog and then start doing field trials. It's sort of like, you know, it's the difference between me trying to learn Spanish now as trying to learn it when I was, you know, 5. I probably would have learned it a lot easier at 5 and it would have stuck. Now it, you know, it's just not as easy, you know, just like people, the older the dog gets, you know, their learning curve slows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But both formats are great. And I really highly encourage hunters to, you know, it's a great off season game. It's fun for the dog. It's a great community of people. There's a lot of it in California, probably more, maybe not as much as there used to be, but you know, there was a bunch of good hunt test, clubs, you know, in California. So,
And they aren't breed specific, right? Like there could be a golden retriever going up against a lab, against a Chesapeake, against exactly. Whatever.
Yep. Depending on the, you know, whether it's a HRC or AKC, like I'm probably more familiar with AKC because that's what I ran, but, you know, there's a variety of breeds and, you know, you just mentioned that I think you can run poodles in some events and Nova Scotia duck tolling retrievers, but they're, you know, flat coated retrievers, they're all retrieving breeds. But, you know, if you get to the field trials, it's really going to be like 99. It's going to be about, you know, 80% labs, probably 15% goldens and 5%, Chesapeakes or, you know, I don't, there's actually a few more Chesapeakes out on the West Coast. Some of the better Chesapeake breeders and stuff, you know, historically were from Oregon and the West. So there's some great Chessies out there, but, yeah, any retrieving breed can compete, but they compete against each other, you know? So,
Yeah. I think I've seen an uptick in folks, at least through the hunt program, getting what I guess I'd call multi-use dogs, Griffons and such, that where these newer onset hunters are wanting to experience, you know, pheasant hunts as well as duck hunts, and they don't know what they like, so they get kind of a multi-tool dog. So it's cool to see these dogs become more prominent.
It really is. You know, we're actually on Monday, the NAVDA Invitational starts in Iowa, and so that's the 8th, I think, of September, and it's really cool to see what the competitive dogs do, and that's testing sort of versatile dogs against versatile dogs. So there, you're not asking a short hair to, you know, run a 400 yard blind like a retriever, but likewise, we're not asking a retriever to point bird. So the NAVDA Invitational is a really neat event where versatile dogs, you know, they have to do watermarks, which are doubles. They have to do a big, blind, like a water blind. They do a duck search, or they have to search. And then, of course, they have to point and, retrieve to hand and all that. So, they have to be steady. So it's really fun. And I think for a lot of hunters, you know, they don't need the, precision of like a field trial retriever, right? They need a dog that can find their ducks. And a lot of the versatile breeds have excellent noses. They're really good at searching. They've been selected and trained to track. So they tend to be really good at finding a lost or wounded bird that, you know, you shot, swam to the tulies, and then, you know, ran off in the tulies, and they gotta trail it. So, it's, you know, I'm seeing more and more versatile dogs duck hunting than I think ever before. And it's great because there's so much they can do with them. And like you said, they're a lot of fun to pheasant hunt and chukar, grouse, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're running towards the end of our podcast, but I wanted to touch on Purina's new sponsorship. You guys are sponsoring the podcast this month, and I know you had worked at a nonprofit, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. So why does somebody like Purina jump on as a sponsorship for somebody like CWA nonprofit out in California, you know, not nationwide, but why is that something that's important to you guys?
Yeah. Really two things. The first is probably the most important in my mind is it's about the dogs, right? People utilize dogs in sporting events, in hunting and all that. And Purina's goal is to make the best dog food for dogs, and especially, you know, these hardworking, active dogs. And, you know, the company's, kind of saying is people and pets are better together. There's lots of research and things that have shown the importance of, you know, the human animal bond and how people live longer, healthier lives when they have a dog or have a companion animal. So, I'd say there's days that dogs stress you out, obviously, but in general, you know, they help people live longer, better lives by having a pet. So, so a lot of it's for the dog and the nutrition of the dog. And then the other part of it, and it's part of why we are, you know, partners with, you know, CWA and DU and Pheasants Forever and other nonprofits, is that, it's the importance of, our environment, clean air, healthy soils, clean water. You know, as a large manufacturer, we have a corporate responsibility to be good stewards of our resources and our ingredients. And you can't grow, you know, good ingredients without, you know, clean water and healthy soils and all those things. So as part of, you know, Nestle's initiatives, we spend money to reduce our, you know, emissions, our carbon footprint. We do more with recycling. And then of course, we spend money to promote a healthy environment. So, you know, I think we do a lot of that in areas that grow, ingredients that we utilize, and rice is a big ingredient that we utilize. And so, you know, with like organizations like CWA and DU that, you know, work with rice growers and rice producers and see the benefit for waterfowl of rice, I think it's a really, it's a natural partnership. So, Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons, but those are a few of them.
Yeah, well, I know we appreciate it as a company, and me and Jeff appreciate you hopping on with us today for an episode of Save for the Blind. Appreciate all the knowledge and the sponsorship that Purina has given us for this month. So again, Carl, wanted to thank you, and hopefully you have a great weekend.
Thanks. It's been great chatting with you guys, and let me know if there's anything I can do to help.
Appreciate it, Carl.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.